I think that's about it. So Luke chapter 8 is where we left off. Thank you. Luke chapter 8. And if you remember last time, the disciples had been in the boat with Jesus during the storm, Storm 101. Storm 201 comes later on where it's them in the boat without Jesus, but they went through the first lesson. And then left that asking themselves, among themselves, what manner of man is this that can just calm the wind and the sea? And then immediately got off the boat and got an answer from a possessed guy saying, I know that thou art the Son of the Most High God. You know, the freaky possessed voice. And Jesus healing the demoniac is where we left it. And of course, the people of the countryside got freaked out by it and asked him to leave. And so he does. And again, he will do that. If you ask him to leave, he's not going to force himself upon you. And so he does. And so we pick up in chapter 8, verse 40. It says this. And it came to pass that when Jesus was returned, the people gladly received him, for they were all waiting for him. And behold, there came a man named Jairus, and he was a ruler of the synagogue, and he fell down at Jesus' feet and besought him that he would come into his house. For he had only one daughter, about 12 years of age, and she lay a-dying. But as he went, the people thronged him. Now, we run into this interesting situation. There's two stories. They're kind of intertwined. They're in three of the four Gospels. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all give accounts of the same thing in the same order, the way this happened. And a guy comes to him named Jairus. It says that his daughter is a dying. In fact, Matthew chapter 9 verse 18, in the same account, he says to her, my daughter is even now dead, she's at the point of death, but come lay thy hand upon her and she shall live. Now, to understand what's going on here, you have to understand who Jairus is and what this means. And it helps to really put yourself in his shoes a little bit. If you, first of all, I don't know if you have any kids. If you do, as your kids get older, you understand what it's like to have a daughter in the house, especially about the time they start hitting 10, 11, 12. They're just a ball of energy. They are fun. Still a little bit silly, but yet also enough adult that they're fun for you, not just tiring. And here's this girl, it's his only daughter, and for 12 years she has been his pride and joy, and now she's at the point where she's about to die. And you know, I study this, and I've got a daughter who's 10 going on 11. I can't imagine being in that place where I'm thinking, you know, any moment and she's gone and she will never light up my house again. It will never be the same. But that's where he is. However, there's a little more to the story, because it says that he's a ruler of the synagogue. Now, the synagogue is, there were synagogues supposedly wherever they were. I think, was it six or more Jewish males? Maybe it was 10 Jewish males. They would have a synagogue. It was the church. It was not the temple. It was one temple served by priests. But this was a synagogue where they would go on Sabbath day. Various teachers would come through and teach. In fact, Jesus made a point of going to the synagogue and teaching at the synagogues. Paul always went to the synagogue. It was where they had the religious services. And the ruler of the synagogue was, he was still what you would consider, I guess, a layman, although I hate that term, laity. But he was not a priest. But yet he was the one in charge of arranging the services, the one in charge of keeping the place where they met, the one, of course, they would have one set of scrolls that was the law, and he would be in charge of that. So he was a man of religious standing. And if you remember in Luke chapter 6, a couple chapters ago, when Jesus claimed to be Lord of the Sabbath, after he made that claim, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day, and that's when the religious leaders showed up and they trotted out the guy with the withered hand, because they wanted to try to trap him, because they knew if he ran into somebody who was hurting or sick on the Sabbath, he would, in their mind, break the law by healing on the Sabbath day because they weren't supposed to do any work on that day. Of course, it's stupid, but so they bring out the guy with the withered hand in the synagogue. And so Jesus calls him out in front of everybody. We went through this a couple weeks ago. And asked them, is it right to do good or to do evil on the Sabbath day? And of course, they're not going to say, oh no, you should do evil. No, he said, it's right to do good. And he tell them to stretch forth his hand, which on the surface is a pretty mean thing to say to somebody whose hand won't stretch forth. That's the whole point. It's withered. It's not working. And then in front of them all, it just, you know, it just comes right back to life again and heals out and stretches out and gets firm. And so he heals him on the Sabbath day. And it said that it drove them to madness that they communed what they would do to him. They plotted to kill him. Jairus was the ruler of the synagogue. He was the religious leader of the place. So presumably he was there, and presumably he had something to do with that. But now he's singing a different tune. See, he had religion. Okay, he was a man of religious standing. In fact, he had, not only had he casually acquainted with religion, he practiced it because he was the ruler of the synagogue. It was all about religion. It was a position. And for somebody who has religion, Jesus can be very annoying. I don't know if you ever found that to be your case, if you grew up with religion. He doesn't go real well with religion. You know, people always say, well, you know, where do you, if it ever comes out that, yeah, I'm a pastor of a church, they'll always, later on, oh, well, you're really religious, right? And they'll ask you some question, and it's like, no, I'm not really religious. Because religion, it comes from relingale, and it means to relink. And religion is man realizing that he's separated from God, trying to link back up with God, and him do something to be able to bridge that gap that he knows it's there. He feels the separation, and he wants to get back to God, so he tries to do things. And there are any number of religious systems that have you doing things to get right with God, whether it be I go to church 3 times a week, or I, you know, say so many prayers and count them out on my beads, or I crawl around on my knees, and whatever it is that I do, I say so many prayers, I don't eat this type of food on this particular day, or I do eat this food, or and religion is always man working their way to God. That's not what we're called to. We're called to have a relationship with Jesus where we recognize that there was nothing we could do. We couldn't reach him. Instead, he reached down to us. And so for somebody who has religion, who believes that they're right with God because they're doing something, to present to them a God who says, you can't do anything to be right with me. I don't care how hard you try. I don't care how many prayers you say. You can't be right with me unless you allow me to do for you what you can't do yourself. That's really offensive. If you think you're pretty good about yourself. And Jairus obviously was at that point, being a ruler of the synagogue, where he felt like he had it wired. He was the one everybody looked to in the synagogue as the mature believer and the mature religious practitioner. But then he gets to the point all of a sudden where his daughter gets sick. And the religion wasn't cutting it anymore. You know, I mean, religion is fine when everything's going okay. But when things start going bad, all of a sudden that doesn't really fit the bill anymore. And in this doing things to be right with God, when things go bad, doesn't cut it. Because then you feel like God's mad at you. And you realize that you doing things is powerless. You know, we're taught from the time we're little, if you've been through public schools like I am, that all you have to do is just look within and the answer is there. If you try really hard, you believe, if you really want it, then you can do anything, which is a lie. I watched some of the Sweet 16, the NCAA tournaments last night. I can't do what those men can do. As much as I want to believe, I am bound by gravity to be below that rim, and there's nothing I can do to get up there and do what those men can do. It's not a matter of looking within myself, because when I look within myself, I see a tremendous lack of ability to do what those people do. And, you know, he has got to the place now where his religion isn't fitting the bill. But at the same time, you know, in the back of his mind, he's thinking, but I remember there was this guy that we couldn't help with our religion. We brought him in to trap Jesus with a withered hand. There's nothing we could do about that. And Jesus just said, stretch forth your hand, and he did. And even though I hated him for it at the time, I saw that guy's hand come back to life again. And now I got a daughter. And there's nothing else I can do. And it, you know, I can understand him in the fact that he waits until she's at the point of death. Because that's usually what we do. Because you don't want to admit, you don't want to break, you don't want to buckle. You want to think that, well, maybe I can do something or else, or maybe she'll snap out of it, or maybe it'll come around. And we look at our situation, you know, we get to the place where we're so separated from God and our life is crashing, and you think, well, maybe it'll come back. Well, you know, if I just, you know, think about tomorrow, let all your, whatever, you know, you think it'll come back around. And then he waits to the point where there ain't no tomorrow. She's dying. She's at the point of death. And he has a decision to make. And it's more than just the standard decision of, do I ask Jesus to heal her or not? Because he's the leader of the synagogue. We know at this point from reading through John that they had said anybody who had anything to do with Jesus would be put out of the synagogue. They would be excommunicated. So if he goes to Jesus, not only is he humbling himself and saying, yes, I'm a loser, I was plotting to kill you, but now I need you, he also would lose his position. He would lose his standing in the community. He would lose, you know, basically he'd be excommunicated. He could lose his, on one regard, he could lose his family, because even in the Jewish, you know, people who are Orthodox Jews, if I'm an Orthodox Jew and my daughter or my son turns to Christ, I would, what's called sit shiva for you, which is, you're dead to me. You're dead. You've abandoned the faith. I don't know you anymore. You know, there's a big cost to this guy. I don't know if you've been following the news at all, but there's been a story in the news over in Afghanistan. You seen that? Where there's a guy who's a Christian, and he's in prison over in Afghanistan. He's going to go on trial for being a Christian because they believe in Sharia, the Muslim law, based upon the Quran. And the law says if anybody abandons Islam, they need to be put to death. So this guy's in prison. He's getting ready to go on trial for believing in Jesus. Now, and I printed off a news story because there's some great quotes in this. Remember, I don't like to slam other religions. You know that. But what are you laughing at? But this is the religion of peace that we just need to understand. This is the religion of peace, okay? This guy, he's a Christian. It's come known that he's going on trial. And all he'd have to do is convert back to Islam and he'd be fine. That would be all it would take. But he won't do it. And so, you know, the president has said he's very concerned about it. Condoleezza Rice has called over to the head of state and asked that perhaps they would regain some sanity and let this man live because he made a choice. Well, this news story says the clerics, who are the Muslim religious leaders, call for the Christian convert's death despite the Western outrage. Kabul, Afghanistan. Senior Muslim clerics said Thursday that an Afghan man who converted from Islam to Christianity must be executed. And if the government caves into Western pressure and frees him, they will incite the people to pull him to pieces. Here's a quote. I like this. Rejecting Islam is insulting God. We will not allow God to be humiliated. This man must die, said cleric Abdul Rauf, who is considered a moderate. He's a moderate, and he's saying, boy's got to die because he's believed in Jesus. Let me just read this little section. Diplomats have said that the Afghan government was searching for a way to drop the case, and on Wednesday, authorities said Rahman is suspected of being mentally ill and would undergo psychological examinations, because obviously anybody would deny Jesus rather than die, so he's got to be crazy. But three Sunni preachers and a Shiite one, interviewed by the Associated Press and four of Kabul's most popular mosques, said they don't believe Rahman is insane. He's not crazy. He went in front of the media and confessed to being a Christian. The government is scared of the international community, but the people will kill him if he is freed. Rauf, who is a member of the country's main Islamic organization, the Afghan whatever council, agreed, saying, the government are playing games. The people will not be fooled. Cut off his head, he exclaimed, sitting in a courtyard outside the Harati Mosque. We will call on the people to pull him to pieces so there is nothing left. He said the only way for Rahman to survive would be for him to go out into exile outside of Afghanistan. But, said Marasa Nasi, the top cleric at the different mosque, one of the largest Shiite places of worship in Kabul, Brahman must not be allowed to leave the country. If he is allowed to live in the West, then others will claim to be Christian so they can too. He said, we must set an example. He must be hanged. You know, now, for us, you hear somebody say, you need to accept Christ, and you feel it in your heart, you say, I should do this, but then you think, everybody's going to look at me, I can't do it. I can't let anybody know that I... We know nothing of somebody saying, we're going to pull you to pieces if you accept Jesus. You're going to lose your family, you're going to lose your job, we're going to kill you. Everybody's going to abandon you. That's where this guy was at. Well, Jairus is at the place where for him to turn to Christ at this point means dropping everything. And yet, it's his daughter. And so he goes and he humbles himself. He throws himself down in front of her. And he says, you know, she lay a dying. If you come and put your hand on her, she shall live. But as he went, it said to people throwing him. So immediately Jesus goes up and goes. This guy comes. Now, Jesus didn't say, oh, I remember you, Mr. Withered Hand. I remember what you did to me. Oh, yeah, yeah, come in to kill me. And now you've got a little problem, do you, huh? No, there was none of that. He just got up and went. And, you know, there is the tendency on our part to think, man, I was so bad to God. All those years I picked on Christians or I made fun of whatever. He's going to hate me. But notice that love bears no record of wrongs. And he immediately gets up and he goes. But as he goes, the people just throng him. Literally, it's almost, the idea is to choke out. They're just all over him. They're on Jesus because everybody wants a part of him. And on the way there, we run into the second individual. It says in verse 43, a woman having an issue of blood 12 years, which had spent all her living on physicians, neither could be healed of any, came behind him and touched the border of his garment. And immediately her issue of blood stanched. Now, when you look at the various Gospels, Luke, who wrote this one, was a doctor. And he mentions the fact that she had spent all her living upon physicians and couldn't be healed by any. Mark is a little more realistic. He says this in Mark 5:26, and had suffered many things of many physicians, and had spent all that she had, and was nothing bettered, but rather grew worse. But you have to understand, when you look at the practices of the day of medicine, it was understandable. First of all, she had an issue of blood. When a woman hits her time of the month, she has an issue of blood, normally for about a week. That's it. Well, for her, this wasn't that time of the month. It was that time of the 12 years. This had started and it had gone on for 12 years. Imagine 12 years of and so you got to figure her condition, because she's continually bleeding for 12 years, which means she's anemic, which means she's weak. Not only that, when you look through the Leviticus, it talks about that particular situation in Leviticus chapter 15, because when a woman was going through her normal time like that, she was to be separated. There are a lot of different prescriptions in the Old Testament law about uncleanness. And part of it was, if a woman had an issue of blood, or if anybody was bleeding, they were unclean and you didn't touch them. Or if you did, you would become unclean. And of course, we look at that and we say, well, that makes obvious sense, because we know how the world deals with blood these days, because we know things about diseases that we didn't know back then. I remember, it amazes me now to go to a basketball game. And, you know, if some poor kid out there pops a pimple on the court, they stop everything, they haul him off, they bring out the bleach. I mean, I remember I was playing in a men's league tournament. It must have been quite a few years ago now. Anyways, I was up in Holton, and I was diving for a ball with another guy. We both dove for the ball, and he was a little bit ahead of me, and he got to it first. And so what you do when you get your hands on the ball is you pull it in so that nobody else can get their hands on it. So as he pulled it in, my face was right there. And so he goes, bang, and he snaps me right underneath the eye, you know, and I'm down like, oh, you know, because it hurt. I mean, it didn't kill, but it hurt. And so I'm like, oh, I'm bleeding, you know. So I go to the sideline, because there's just guys there, but there's a bunch of teams, and I knew some of the men, and there was one of the guys that I went to high school with was sitting there, and I'm like, oh, and he throws me this towel, and I put it on my face. I'm like, how's it look? Well, what had happened is he had popped me right on the cheekbone. It's almost like when boxers, and so I got cut, and I had a cut underneath my eye about an inch and a half long, and my cheek was sagging down, so I had this gap. And, you know, and so I got blood all over this towel, and I'm like, oh, I'll get it back. And he's like, keep it, man. I don't want it. Because once the blood's all over it, nobody wants it. But back then it was like, you know, the guy brushes off his elbow and they keep playing. Well, now it's not the same thing, man. If you work in a school or anything like that, if there's an issue of blood, boys, we pull out the bleach, you put on your rubber gloves, you call a hazmat team. I mean, you don't mess with blood because we know how much is borne by blood. Well, Lord obviously knew that back then. And part of their cleanliness laws, if you look at the dietary laws, you look at their cleanliness laws, it all, the science behind all of it. And the Lord had said, when someone is bleeding, stay away. And so if you had your issue of blood, your woman, you were separated for your week. If it continued beyond that, you were separated until it was done. So that meant anything she sat on would be unclean, so nobody could sit in. Anything she had laid on, anybody she touched. So as a result, she was put out. She was ostracized. She wasn't allowed to be around people, around a family. Not only that, but on top of that, you had man's religious interpretation that went on top of the law. And what men said was, well, obviously, if a woman has a continuous issue of blood in that way, it's because of sin in her life. She's obviously been immoral. She's been sleeping around, and so now she's bleeding, and she's getting her fair due. And as a result of such, not only is she put out for cleanliness reasons, but she is now cast out. It was reasonable for her husband to divorce her. Her family would leave her. And all of the religious community looked at her like there was sin in her life. In reading through Alfred Edersheim, who is a Jewish historian, and he talks about a section in the Talmud where there were 11 or 12 ancient prescriptions for someone who had an issue of blood like that. About half of them were different things that you mixed up and drank to try to cure it. The other half were just crazy things like, one was you had to carry around the ashes from an ostrich egg in a handkerchief, and that would cure you. Or you would have to find a barley corn seed picked out of the dung of a white donkey, and you would do things with that. I mean, it was all crazy medicine, and that's why Luke can say and Matthew can say she had seen doctors and she tried everything, and she was not better, she was worse for it. And so here's a woman who, as opposed to Jairus, who has had 12 years of life and happiness in his home and who has had religion, here's a woman who for 12 years has had suffering and separation and has been rejected by religion. Religion doesn't want anything to do with her because religion said she was immoral and unclean, and she wasn't immoral and unclean. I mean, there's no indication that that's why she had this problem, but she had this problem, and she was ostracized, so much so that she wasn't even supposed to be in the crowd. But it tells us, when you read the account in the various Gospels, that she got in her mind, if she could just grab the hem of his robe, she'd be made whole. It says in Mark, in that same section, that when she heard of Jesus, she came into the press behind and touched his garment. Now, as somebody who would be put out, she would have been hanging around the lepers. And we know what he's been doing with the lepers. He's been cleansing the lepers. So somehow word has come to this woman that there's a guy who can heal people like us, who actually will deal with people like us. In fact, if she had talked to any of the lepers that he'd actually put his hands on, he'd touched. Because you remember the last leper we read about, nobody had touched him for how many years, and now he's touching lepers, and she thinks, there's somebody that would actually touch me, who doesn't think that I'm immoral, who hasn't put me out. And so she comes in the crowd, obviously discreetly, because she can't let anybody see her, because she's not supposed to be in among the people because she's still bleeding. And she says, if I can just grab the border of his garment. Now, you got to understand, first of all, it's not just touch. The word says touch, but if you look at the Greek underneath it, it's latch onto. It's to grasp. It's to cling to. It's to grab. And beyond that, there's a reason why it was the border of his garment. If you remember from earlier in Numbers, we're still going through Numbers on Thursday night, in Numbers chapter 15, verse 38, it says this. This is the Lord talking to Moses, and he says, speak unto the children of Israel and bid them that they make fringes in the borders of their garments throughout their generations, and that they put upon the fringe of the borders a ribbon of blue, and it shall be unto you for a fringe, that you may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord and do them, and that you seek not after your own heart and your own eyes, after which you used to go a-whoring. And the Lord had commanded that all of the men in Israel would take and put this border around their garments with tassels on there, and it would be blue, and it would be a reminder of the commandments of the Lord. And so all of the good religious men of the day did that. They had these borders on there. In fact, Matthew tells us of Jesus speaking about the Pharisees, the religious leaders who thought they were good for doing works. He said that they would make broad their phylacteries, and they like to enlarge the borders of their garments. Because if having a border around your garment signified the commandments, well, obviously, the bigger my border, the more holy that I am. And everybody needs to know how holy I am, so I'll just put a big old ribbon, you know. So then they get into to ribbon contests of who's got the biggest border around their garment. And, of course, here's a woman who's used to seeing these religious leaders with their big flashy borders that talk about how they know the Word of God, and yet they despise her, they cast her out, they don't want anything to do with her, they say she's immoral. And it's almost as if for the first time in her life she sees somebody whose life matches up with what they say they believe. You know, she sees somebody who's got a border around their garment, and yet their life represents life, and it represents healing, and it represents acceptance. It doesn't represent condemnation, because that's all she's ever got out of religion. I don't know, you might have grown up in a system like that where all you ever got out of going to church was feeling really bad. God is mad at me, man, and I just got to go in here once a week and take a tongue lashing from whoever's up front, and he just tells me, you're going to hell. And then I, hell, you're right. And then I go out every week, but I've done my time, so... That's what this woman had experienced. But now finally she sees somebody that's different. And she said to herself, if I can just grab him, if I can just get a hold of that, I'll be healed. I know I will. And so she comes up behind him, it says in verse 44. She came behind him in the middle of the crowd. Remember, they're thronging him, which means everybody's there. It's packed. It's just a sea of people. And she grabs the border of his garment. And immediately her issue of blood was stanched. She felt it. Just as soon as that happens, boom. She's healed. She knows it inside, because if you've been bleeding for 12 years and you're weak and anemic, it doesn't mean the bleeding stopped, but she's weak and anemic, but all of a sudden, I mean, no, she's just like everybody else. When he heals somebody who's missing fingers, boom, 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 they get fingers. He heals somebody who's anemic from bleeding, boom, it's like a transfusion has happened, and she is back. She's healthy. She feels right and whole again for the first time in her life, or at least in 12 years. And Jesus, it says in verse 45, and Jesus said, who touched me? And when all denied, Peter and they that were with him said, Master, the multitude throng thee and press thee, and sayest thou, who touched me? And Jesus said, somebody has touched me, for I perceive that virtue has gone out from me. Now, who touched me? He's in a crowd of thousands of people. Peter, and it mentions Peter by name here in Luke, because he's a ringleader, but they all were in agreement, it says in the various Gospels. Who touched you? Everybody touched you. What do you mean, who touched you? They all touched you. Somebody pick your pocket? Who touched you? The crowd. What are you talking about? Interesting. If you notice this and you read in the various accounts, look what it says in verse 45. When it says, Jesus said, who touched me? When all denied. All denied. You know what all means? It means all, including the lady who grabbed his border. She grabs it, and then she backs off, and then he stops and says, who touched me? And looks around the crowd, and everybody's going, I don't know, including the woman who's saying, I don't know. You know, I mean, she's doing one of those things. Nobody's, nothing to see here, move along. Because she just wanted to touch him and get out. She didn't want to make a scene. See, she wasn't supposed to touch him, first of all. And you know she's got this deep-seated fear, oh no, I made the master unclean. Because the normal law is if something unclean touches somebody else who isn't, they become unclean until they go through the purification. It's a different story with Jesus. He doesn't take negative. He gives positive. So when he touches something that's unclean, it becomes clean. There's a difference. But she doesn't know that. And she's, first of all, she's just looking to get in and get out and get on. You know, meanwhile, remember where they're going. They're on their way to Jairus' house, whose daughter is at the point of death. So he's like, you know, doing the look at the watch thing. Nobody here. Let's go. You know, he wants to go. He's got one thing in his mind. My daughter lays a dying. I have put everything on the line. Let's get moving. But Jesus stops. And he does not allow her to just come in and do a little silent thing and get out there again. Because that's not all she needs. She needs to be healed physically, yes. But there's more that needs to take place. And it says, all denied. And the idea, when you read the other Gospels, is that he looked around and he looked at her and said, who touched me? And she knows she could not be hid. It says when she realized she could not be hid, Well, yeah, right there in verse 47. Verse 46, somebody's touched me. I perceive that virtue has gone out from me. The word virtue there in the Greek is dunamis, which is power, which is the same power available to us through the Holy Spirit. But he felt it go because someone had touched him in faith. And it says in verse 47, and when the woman saw that she was not hid, she came trembling and falling down before him. She declared unto him before all the people for what cause she had touched him and how she was healed immediately. Now, she's trembling. Why is she trembling? Have you ever had a pet that's been abused? You ever? Hopefully not by you, but if you've ever like inherited a pet from somebody else that's been hit one too many times, all you got to do is make a quick movement. I mean, they just cower. And here's a woman who's been beat for 12 years by religion. Her view of God is, he's the God waiting up there with the lightning bolt, and as soon as I make a misstep, whew, down it comes. I'm slaughtered. I still remember Bob Cole singing that song that he learned when he was a kid, to be careful, little eyes, what you see. Be careful, little eyes, what you see. The song says, because the Father up above is looking down in love. But he always felt like it was, the Father up above will squash you like a bug. Be careful. You know, like if you step out of line, you're done for. You know, be careful, little feet, where you go, because he's waiting. Well, this woman has been abused by religious people for 12 years. And now she's been healed. And you know what's going through her mind. One, I did something wrong. I touched him and I wasn't supposed to touch him. I know I wasn't supposed to touch him, but I just knew I'd be healed. And now he's going to find out that I touched him. And what? He's going to take it away? It's going to be snatched away from me? And so she comes trembling. She's afraid. She falls down before him. And she tells him everything about what happened. And he said unto her, daughter, be of good comfort. Thy faith has made thee whole. Go in peace. Now that word daughter is a diminutive term, which means it's endearing. It's the only time that Jesus uses this phrase to talk to a woman. This is the only woman that he ever addresses this way. And it's, for me, when I talk to Abby, I call her sweetie. Sweetie, would you go get me this? Sweetie, would you go get me that? Becca, honey, would you go through, you know, I talk to my daughters in an endearing way. And here's a woman for 12 years who has felt like God is mad at her and she's messed up and she can never be accepted. And she comes face to face with God in the flesh. And he calls her sweetie. He says, sweetie, be of good comfort. Literally, the Greek is, you have nothing to fear. There's nothing for you to be afraid of. Not don't be scared, suck up your courage, but there's nothing for you to be afraid of. Nothing. Thy faith has made thee whole. Go in peace. And again, it's not that it was the extreme power of her faith that heals her. It's her faith brought her to the place where she acted on it. And the outward expression of her grabbing that garment was what she already believed in her heart, is that that one can make me whole. Now, she has been put out from the congregation. We don't know from here where it goes. We don't know if she's brought back in. Presumably, if she was married, she would have been divorced. We don't know if she gets her husband back. We don't know if she gets her kids back. We don't know if it's all right in the end. But we do know that for the rest of her life, no matter how the world treats her, she can look back at that one moment when she looked into the eyes of God and he said, sweetie, you don't have anything to fear. Go in peace. Now, Jairus, at this point, has got to be dying inside. If you've ever been when you're trying to get someplace, I have vivid memories of trying to get to sporting events when I was a kid. And my, you know, you can't drive, and so your mother's got to drive you. You're playing in a game somewhere. And she just is not on your timetable at all. And she's just, well, yeah, we're going to stop and get a few things. And I'm thinking, get a few things? I got to change. I got to warm up. I stink. You know, I got to play. And she's, well, you know, oh, yeah. Oh, look, it's Miss. Let's just talk to her for a minute. You're like, oh, we got to go. We got to go. We got to go. And here's Jairus. His daughter's dying at the point of death. He has thrown everything on the line. He's thrown him down before Jesus. He's risked his entire everything for the chance, hoping against hope, that this man can heal her. And he's actually going, and he stops to deal with this woman. Okay, yes, 12 years. I've had a daughter for 12 years. She's getting ready to die. This woman's dealt with this for 12 years. Why couldn't she have dealt with it for 12 years in a day? Mine's going to die. You know, he wants to go. And yet, Unfortunately, or not unfortunately, this was necessary. And I think Jesus, part of why Jesus stopped and dealt with this woman is because she needed to realize not only does God want you to be whole, God wants to know, wants you to know that he loves you and you have nothing to fear. But this is also for Jairus, because look what happens next. While he yet spake, before they get there, and we don't know how far the distance is, presumably it's a little ways, while he yet spoke, there cameth one from the ruler of the synagogue's house, saying to him, thy daughter is dead. Trouble not the master. It's too late. Now, old Jairus has got to be on the roller coaster of life. I don't know. But he was at the absolute bottom. And then he risks everything and he asks Jesus to come in. Jesus immediately gets up and starts going, which means he's now at the top and he's got hope. And then he crests as that woman grabs him and everybody stops. And now he's at the absolute bottom again because they just showed up and says, too late, your daughter's dead. Don't bother Jesus anymore. Too late. And Jesus immediately, when Jesus heard it, he answered him saying, fear not, believe only, and she shall be made whole. When his faith was at the point of being crushed, Jesus stepped in and let him know, fear not, believe only, she shall be made whole. Notice that there is no condition put on that. He doesn't say, when Jesus heard it, he answered him saying, fear not, believe only, if you believe only, she shall be made whole. That's not there. It is, don't be afraid, just believe, she will be made whole. Even if your faith isn't quite up to snuff, when we get there, she's going to be made whole. There was no question in the Lord's mind. It was not dependent upon Jairus' faith. But he didn't want Jairus to despair, and so he says, fear not, believe only. Again, he had just told the woman, you have nothing to fear. Now he tells Jairus, fear not. And of course, Jairus had the word of God. He was acting upon the word. The Lord had said, let's go. I mean, he had agreed he was going to heal her. But then he got to the place where he was shaken. And the Lord, I think part of this was orchestrated in such a way, because she had died most likely before they met the woman on the way, because they had dispatched someone to come up and tell him that his daughter was dead. And the Lord had arranged this in such a way that he would get the news after seeing a demonstration of Jesus' power to be able to heal a woman who had been in the process of dying for 12 years. And so they go the rest of the way. Verse 51, and when he came into the house, he suffered no man to go in save Peter, James, and John, and the father and mother of the maiden. So they get there, and of course the crowd is there, and they're thinking, we're going to see something today. Forget the woman that was bleeding. We're going to see somebody raised. Because, you know, they're hearing this, and so the crowd is there. But he doesn't allow the crowd to come in. He only brings his disciples and the mother and father. It says, and all wept and bewailed her. But he said, weep not. She's not dead, but sleepeth. And they laughed him to scorn, knowing that she was dead. Now, again, he was the ruler of the synagogue, which would have made him somewhat of a well-known and important person. The way funerals here versus funerals in that part of the world today are still very different. When somebody dies here, in Lincoln, Hervey Clay shows up, for the most part, because he's the only funeral home in town, and he picks up the body and he takes him and they embalm the body, and then they schedule the viewing, which would be in the next day, too, and then the funeral would be the day after that. Over there, frequently, somebody dies, they put them in the ground that day because it's warm and it's moist and they don't embalm, which means they stink really quick. So that's why, you know, whenever there's a bombing in Israel or there's, you know, somebody's gunned down over in the Middle East, you see the big procession through town with the body laying on a pallet covered in a sheet and everybody wailing and crying as they haul them off to bury him that day because it's got to be done. So this was something that was going to happen fast. And one of the things they did is the measure of grief had to be commensurate with your social standing. The more important you are, the more you want everybody to know how important you are. And so when somebody close to you dies, of course you want a big show. So they actually had professional mourners. They would hire people to come in and wail and mourn and cry. And you can tell it's not close relatives that he's dealing with here, because He walks through the door with the mom and the dad and Peter, James, and John, and they're all weeping. The whole place is filled with these people that are mourning and bewailing her. And you know, it takes a real professional to really put, I mean, you've heard the wailing going on. So here's the pros bewailing this poor child. And he walks through the door and says, "Don't cry, she's just sleeping." And immediately they go from, I mean, they immediately start laughing at him and laughed him to scorn, knowing that she was dead. Because again, they're professionals. I know a dead body, okay? This is my third one today. I've been crying at two other places. That girl dead. All right, she ain't asleep. She's dead. Look at her. Dead. You know, pick up the arm. She dead. She just, there's no ha, 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 funny man, Mr. Religious guy. You know, you might know your carpenter. You might know your whatever. But we know dead, and that girl is dead. And to think that she's asleep. Come on, you kid. You know, and so they immediately start scorning and mocking him because they knew she was dead. I like what he does in verse 54. It says, and he put them all out. He put them all out. And that's biblical. Proverbs 22:10 says, cast out the scorner, and contention shall go out. Yea, strife and reproach shall cease. All strife in that house ceased as soon as he kicked them out. And I, you know, there's several other verses in Proverbs that talking about smiting the scorner. I wouldn't be surprised if he, you know, he was a carpenter. Sometimes we look at Jesus and you won't see any Jesus paintings on the wall here, okay? I promise. There's several things that I've come out and said you won't see here at the church. One is the thermometer, you know, for the fundraiser, showing how sick we are. Another one is the Jesus painting. I went to a church with my grandmother when I was a kid, and there's this big old picture in the front of this. He's white, but he's got a tan because he's from the Middle East, but they make it, you know, the features are all white. And he's effeminate, his day is long. He's got long hair, and he just looks like this sissy guy. Jesus was not a sissy, okay? He was a carpenter. You're not a carpenter out there and be a sissy. He wasn't. You remember when he was walking on the water, and Peter starts walking out and then starts to sink, and it says Jesus reaches down and pulls him up. I mean, he one-arm curls Peter, and Peter was a big guy. He pulls him up out of there. He made a whip, and he kicked over the tables and drove out the money changers. He was not a little sally guy. It was okay to be masculine. I mean, he was again, if you look at the Genesis account where you have Adam was created, and then the Lord took part of him and made Eve. And I believe in many ways he took more than, it wasn't just a rib, it was a side. It was a feminine side, and there was a division there. And in general, you'll notice that men tend to be masculine and women tend to be feminine. In all things equal, men have more muscle mass than women. Men are going to be stronger. And I believe firmly that Jesus was the perfect man. And Jesus was absolutely masculine, and yet he was also tender and merciful at the same time. And so he was able to be gentle. He was able to be gentle to the woman who's been beat up by religion. But he's also able to clear out the house if it needs to be cleared out. And so he kicks these people out, which they had coming, because they were scornful. And they were not believing. And of course, that would have an effect on Jairus. He already immediately answered Jairus to help keep his faith where it needed to be, to help him have hope. And now he walks into his house, and there's a bunch of people as the professional mourners who would know death, and they're being scornful. And Jesus kicks him out, you know. Well, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:33, be not deceived, evil communications corrupt good manners, or bad company corrupts good morals, if you look at some of the other translations. And Paul says, awake to righteousness and sin not, for some have not the knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame. And Paul was basically telling him, look, do you understand? There are some people, they're just scorners. They don't know God. They don't want to know God. And all they're going to do is drag you down. I was down in Portland a little while ago listening to Vince, who was a pastor down there. And he was saying, you know, if you have a German shepherd, and he escapes, and he goes out in the woods, and he hooks up with a wolf pack, you're not going to go out your backyard and find your German shepherd along with five wolves acting like German shepherds, because he tamed them and brought them all home. No, what you end up with is a German shepherd acting like a wolf, because we have this tendency to think, if I could just get back to my old friends, they'll see the change in my life and I'll bring them all. Well, maybe. But you can't go back and have fellowship with your old friends, because they will be like slime, drag it, you'd be sucked into the pit. It's quicksand. And these people, we're not going to help the situation. And so we kicked them out. You know, and sometimes it's important for us to remember, is there anybody we need to separate ourselves from? Not just for our benefit, but for theirs. Because you cannot have a powerful witness on somebody's life if they continually suck you back into sin. I know it's a game for your old friends to try to get you to be like you used to be, because it illegitimizes what you've believed and it makes you real. Oh, it's just a phase he's going through. See, you're no different. You're just like you always were. Come on, come on, have this. Come on, have that. Have some. You're not going to drop acid with your friends and witness and lead them to the Lord. It's not going to happen, because it's going to be hollow. It's going to be empty. There'll be no change. And so some of us need to separate ourselves from some people in our lives that are dragging us down. And he kicks them out of the house. And then he took her by the hand, the cold, limp hand, and he called, saying, "Maid, arise." Now Matthew tells us he actually spoke Aramaic. And it's interesting, because even though he was Jewish and spoke Hebrew, and this was written in Greek, the language, common language of the day, was Aramaic. And he says to her, "Talitha kumai," which literally is, "Little lamb, arise." He calls her little lamb. It says, "And her spirit came again, and she rose straightway, and he commanded to give her meat. And her parents were astonished, but he charged them that they should tell no man what was done." Her spirit came again. You know, if you're, I know you've heard me talk in the past about Jehovah's Witnesses. I'm waiting for them to come back. They hit Bob's house the other day when his wife was there. He had a couple ladies come. One of the things, they don't believe in a spirit. You know, you just, your body and soul, and you die, you go to sleep as your soul, and then your soul wakes back up. You know, nope. Right here it says her spirit came again, which means it was gone somewhere else. He said, "Little lamb, arise," and the spirit came back into the body. And she rose straightway. And now, I don't know where she was. Definitely that is the definition of a long-distance call. But she heard his voice clear, plain as day. And it was, and her spirit comes back in, and she wakes back up. And then he tells him to give her something to eat, because he realizes she's in this world, and there are still physical needs. And her parents were astonished. But he should charge them that they should tell no man what was done. Now, you look at this and you have this very interesting contrast between these two people. You have one who grew up with religion, but came to the point where he realized religion didn't cut it. I need something more than that. I need a relationship. I need the touch of God. I don't need me doing something, because that's not fitting the bill. And a guy who embraced religion. And then on the other hand, you have this woman who was a religious reject, which I'm sure some of you guys were, because there's a lot of churches that wouldn't want anything to do with some of us at all because of how bad we are or were. But either way, there's a home for those people, for both types of people, with Jesus. You know, and really, as we close, let me ask you this. If you don't know him, all right, if you have been living your life apart from him, you know you're not right with God. What he said to Jairus really applies, which is, "Fear not, believe only, and instead of she, you shall be made whole." Jesus is more than able to do what he said he would do. And that means, if anyone comes to him, I will no wise cast out. If you come to the place where you realize you are a sinner, you realize that you need a change in your life, that you've been separated from God, don't be afraid. Just believe, and you can be made whole. Now, if you do know him, but yet you've been going your life like that woman, and you think that God's mad at you because you haven't measured up, you know, his words to her are pretty good, which is, "Be of good comfort. Thy faith has made thee whole. Go in peace." Literally, go into peace. You know, and from that, for that woman, from that point on, no matter what she came up against in her life, she could look back and realize, "I'm his daughter. I have nothing to fear." We'll pray. If you need prayer afterwards, whether you don't know the Lord and you want to, come see me and I'll be glad to pray with you, and you can be made whole. If you've been just suffering, find somebody to pray with. Grab me, grab one of the guys up front, grab one of the ladies, you know, see my wife. We'd be glad to pray with you, because this life can really beat you up sometimes. And yet the Lord wants you to be made whole. Let's pray. Lord, thank you so much that you're a God, Lord, who not only wants to heal infirmities, Lord, but also let us know how much you love us, that we're accepted. Lord, thank you so much that you're a God who will help people who rejected you for years and years and years, like Jairus. Lord, I pray that you'd work on every heart here. Lord, you know there are areas in all of our lives that are not right, that need to change, need to be more like you. Certainly, Lord, if there's anyone here who is out of fear, never submitted to you, have never asked you into their life, I pray, Father, that you would do a miracle in their heart. Give them the strength to trust you. They won't be disappointed. And Father, I pray that if there's anyone here who has just been beat up, feel like they haven't measured up, Lord, please let them know that you love them. They have nothing to fear from you. God, please continue to work here, we pray. Lord, and make our lives represent you in a way that's right. Lord, that's our desire, to just live as your children. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Grace and peace, guys.